Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. My co-host John Perry is away today. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco, continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. Imagine the following scene. An 18-month-old boy is dancing joyously, if clumsily, to the music of Prince, his Let's Go Crazy, let's say. His mother is so delighted that she whips out the camcorder, takes a video, and posts it on YouTube to share with family and friends. But someone else is also watching. That's Universal Music Group, which administers some of the copyrights to Prince's music. Universal is jealous of its rights, and it threatens the mother and insists that YouTube take down the video. Fearing for its own liability, YouTube complies. Welcome to the copyright wars. For whose benefit are these wars being waged, and at what cost? I'll put those questions and more to my guest, Lawrence Lessig, author of Remix, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy. He thinks our copyright laws are outmoded, that they stifle creativity, and that they serve no one's real interest. What do you think? Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. But first, our roving philosophical reporter, April Dymbosky, takes a closer look at one battle in the copyright wars, where public art and political activism meet in the marketplace. She files this report.
Viewing art on a busy commercial street can be quite different from contemplating Chagall at the museum. Many cities have public art programs with sculptures on sidewalks and murals on freeway on-ramps. Tourists snap photos of those works all the time, but when advertisers or professionals sell those pictures, that's illegal.
Everybody thinks that they can just take it because it's out there on the street. That's not any more true than you can take somebody's parked car.
Brooke Oliver is a San Francisco attorney. She says copyright law doesn't distinguish between bus stop murals and Mickey Mouse.
It really does protect poorer artists every bit as much as it protects a record label or, you know, a huge film company. So it really does protect the little guy.
In 2000, she filed a lawsuit against Corbis, a stock photography company. They were selling photographs of a mural from Cesar Chavez Elementary School on the internet. The mural was meant to educate students about the farm worker movement in California. Oliver represented the muralists.
They spent 8 months working on that mural for virtually no money at all. You don't want to just have somebody else walk out, snap a photograph of it, and make hundreds of dollars.
Well, I felt ripped off.
Juana Alicia was a lead artist for the mural and a union organizer with Cesar Chavez.
These are images that triumph and celebrate the struggles of some of the poorest people on the planet. Getting exploited in that way was a little more, you know, insult to injury.
Making a living as an independent artist is hard enough. Without the protection of copyright laws, a career in art could become a mere hobby.
We are human beings too. We have families. We need to support ourselves. So it's important for us to be able to protect our rights.
Attorney Oliver also represented the United Farm Workers Union. They own the copyrights of the Black Eagle logo and the images of Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta painted in the mural.
The families, Dolores and Cesar's family and the foundation that was set up to protect his memory, want to make sure that those icons of social change are used in connection with things that they value and not just some, you know, some product out there, some computer or some water bottle or something like that.
In the end, Corbis settled the case out of court, and they lobbied for several new state laws giving artists even greater protections. The UFW has also filed lawsuits protecting the trademark of the union's well-known rallying cry, Si se puede, yes, it can be done.
There are musical tones or phrases or symbols that bring to mind among consumers the source of certain things. And Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta coined the phrase, si se puede.
Si se puede! Obama away! Gone away!
Even the Obama presidential campaign got permission to use the phrase in its Spanish ads.
The UFW granted him a free license because the UFW endorsed Obama. It might have been different if McCain tried to use it.
Yes, we can.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm April Demboski.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today I'm joined by Lawrence Lessig. He's a professor of law at Stanford University and author of Remix, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy. Larry, welcome to Philosophy Talk. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Great to be back.
So, Larry, you're perhaps best known for your work developing the Creative Commons and all your books and stuff. And you were on our program discussing copyright issues 4 or 5 years ago. We did this program called Who Owns Ideas. Tell me, what, if anything, has changed since then, either in the law, the world of technology, or in your own thinking? Have things gotten better or worse?
Well, not much has changed in the law, but what has changed is an explosion of recognition in all sorts of sectors that before thought of this as a totally irrelevant issue. So educators and parents as their kids get sued by the recording industry, teachers as they recognize that their ability to take digital technologies and do fantastic things with them is threatened by overreaching copyright law, a whole bunch of new industries, businesses that recognize this more moderate copyright law would be a future for great new innovation. There are many more allies to the side of balance than there were 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think I read in your latest book that lots of people, because of this explosion of people who are utilizing this stuff, and lots of people have been turned into criminals in recent years. Is that right?
Well, the law treats them as criminals. Kids engage in behavior which seems to them perfectly legal, perfectly sensible, but they're told that it's criminal behavior. So what they do is internalize the life of being a criminal. And my concern, one fundamental concern in this book, is that we begin to, this is a corrosive influence. It begins to have effect beyond just the area of copyright law.
So look, I know that you think our copyright laws need to be rewritten and rethought. But before we get into just how and why, I want to ask you a more foundational question to help this conversation get started. Why should there be copyright laws at all? I mean, we'll worry about what kinds of copyright laws, but what is the purpose of having a copyright regime in the law?
Well, copyright law, I think, is an essential part of creating incentives for artists to create great new work. If a film from Hollywood could be produced and the moment it's released, you could share it with your 10,000 best friends online, it would destroy the incentive of Hollywood to make these films or musicians to make their music or authors to write books. So we need some copyright protection. We need a balanced copyright protection to assure that they have the proper incentives they need to produce great new work.
That sounds like a very pragmatic kind of way of thinking about it. Here's another way you might think about it. There should be copyright laws because there should always be laws to protect property. I think up a thought, I write it down. It's my property, just as my house is my property. If I build my house on my own land, sure, there has to be a property law regime. And shouldn't intellectual property just be part of the property, the law of property in general?
Well, of course, it's like the law of property in the sense that I can buy and sell my property just like I can buy and sell my house. But the nature of this property is fundamentally different. As Jefferson wrote in the early part of the 19th century, he who receives an idea from me receives instruction himself without lessening mine, as he who lights his taper at mine receives light without darkening me. So the idea is, intellectual property is the sort of thing where if I share it with you, I still have it. But if you use my Kleenex to blow your nose, I definitely don't have it.
Well,
anymore.
It's one thing to have it as a, okay, if I share my intellectual property with you, I can still have it in the sense I think those thoughts. I can still think those thoughts. But I don't want to just think my thoughts. I want to exploit my thoughts. I want to exploit my thoughts for whatever ends I choose. And if you exploit my thoughts freely, then that may prevent me from exploiting my thoughts.
That's right. And that's why I think copyright law needs to give a limited protection, a limited monopoly for the creator to be able to exploit the thoughts in the way copyright law protects exclusively. But all I'm saying is that it's a different kind of property protection than we typically think of to protect with food or houses or your car. I don't have a fair use right to use your car and for good reason.
Right.
But I do have a fair use right to use your arguments or to use your book because that's essential to enable ideas and culture to spread.
Yeah, there's something you say in one of your I think it's this book. I've read lots of your books, so I may be mixing things up. But there's something you say somewhere. So going back to fair use, in my line of work and your line of work, we're both academics and we write things, and you're also a lawyer, so you write briefs. And in academic work, you quote from the people with whom you're engaged rather liberally. I mean, there are constraints. You can't just take whole passages of their books and foist them off as your own. But you quote from other writers and thinkers rather liberally in order to take a stance relative to them, criticize them, build on them. You talk in your book about the way a lawyer writes a brief. It's full of quotation and citation. And a beautiful brief is like a symphony of pulling things together, essentially remix. And you wonder why music can't be like that. You right? Why we don't have the same standard? First, do I have that right?
You have it exactly right. There's a kind of democratic norm that exists in the context of writing. We all take for granted the right to quote, to build upon in order to write some text. Of course, you have to cite. I think plagiarism is the only crime for which the death penalty is appropriate. So I think you've got to cite, but as long as you cite, you can take and build upon. But the point is, the norms in music and in film and in many parts of art don't yet embrace that same kind of democratic right, and I think it should.
Right, and you think it should, but you tried to think of some difference between music and, say, legal scholarship or other academic scholarship that would explain why they have these different norms, and I take it you don't see an intrinsic difference to the very form. There's no intrinsic reason why citation should work so liberally in our kind of line and not in music. Is that right?
I wouldn't point to the intrinsic nature of anything. That's philosopher's talk. What I would point to is the need to protect differently in order to create the incentives for the artist to create originally. And I don't see any need to protect differently. That should be just the same freedom.
Well, see, I just want to think about that a little bit, because I want to think about the nature of my interest in this intellectual property, if I'm a musician versus a writer. And it seemed to me that it's hard in music to quote another performer, another performance, without yourself performing it as if it's your own. But in academic writing, there's an explicit device for saying that's his, not mine. I quote it or I paraphrase it. I say so and so says. I can't say in a piece of music, can I? Mozart says. So in the very performing of it, I'm taking what is another's performance and performing it like in the first person, as it were.
Well,
isn't that the difference?
Well, no. In the height of classical music, classical music was essentially this type of quoting all the time. Everybody understood when somebody was borrowing because they were all familiar.
Right.
And in the context of remix today, where we're talking about remix of music, when Girl Talk remixes music, he's taking the actual sounds from the other performance and including it in his. So nobody's confused about the fact that it's Girl Talk creating the sounds. It is sounds from somebody else that he is mixing together in order to produce his 212.
So you think you can literally quote, you can literally not perform the other's performance and say, I'm taking a bit of his, here he is.
Yeah.
And then do something with it.
Yeah, no, I think the artists are not sufficiently respectful. I think that they've got to be more respectful and more citation. But it's understandable that they didn't. During hip-hop, the rise of hip-hop, when there were all sorts of lawsuits threatened against people for sampling in the context of producing music, they had to hide the fact they were quoting. But if we were open about it, then they could, you know, produce liner notes that include every single person that was snipped in the production of their
work. The liner notes, right, are one thing. But I'm just wondering, what's the equivalent of the quotation marks where I'm explicitly marking this as not my own in something like a photograph, right? So if I photograph somebody else's photograph, how do I, in the photograph, cite the other guy?
Well, I don't think you should have the right to just reproduce somebody else's photograph. If you're taking somebody's photograph and changing it, transforming it, that's what I think you have a fair use right to do. If you're remixing it, incorporating it with a bunch of other work, I think you have a right to do that. Those things expressly say it's not just my work that I'm doing, it's somebody else's work I'm building on.
Right, so remix is different from just sort of usurpation.
Absolutely,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you're not saying people should be able to usurp other people's work. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is the copyright wars, and we're talking with Larry Lessig, author of Remix, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy. I'd say he's one of the generals of the other side of the copyright wars. That's the band Two Live Crew and their unauthorized remix of Roy Orbison's song, Oh Pretty Woman. The battle over that remix went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the court ruled in Two Live Crew's favor. We're discussing the copyright wars. John Perry is away today. I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. And our guest is Larry Lessig, author of Remix, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy. So, Larry, I take it that you think that the big part of the problem is that 20th century law and 21st century technology are sort of strange bedfellows. Can you say more about the tension between the two?
Right. Well, 21st century technology has empowered an extraordinary range of people to become creators. Remixing content, sharing their remix with others, engaging in a kind of expressive culture that we haven't seen in 100 years. 20th century law presumes that all of that creativity, in some sense, has to be cleared by the lawyers first. And that conflict creates the problems that leads to what is
right.
this battle.
And that's because at some point, the law was changed so that copyright included not just the printing and distribution, but the, quote, copying
right.
of these things.
Right.
And 21st century technology makes all kinds of copies.
Right.
Is that right?
That's exactly right. The law was architected originally around the exception, not the rule. And the exception was making a copy. So it said, when you made a copy, 1909 law did this explicitly for the first time, then you've got to get permission from the copyright owner. Well, of course, in 1909, you made copies through things like printing presses. It didn't really matter. Not many people had a printing press in their back lawn. But when culture moves into the digital age, where no matter what you do on a computer, even just reading text on a computer, you're making a copy, all of a sudden you've produced this world where every single use of culture requires permission of the copyright owner, and that's radically inconsistent.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and our subject is the copyright wars. A combination of 20th century law and 21st century technology, we just said, is turning millions of downloaders and remixers into criminals. Are copyright laws too restrictive, or is modern technology too lawless? Does a law stifle creativity while protecting only narrow corporate interest? But what about independent artists and musicians whose works are also protected by our copyright laws? Join this conversation. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or, as always, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And we've got a caller on the line now. That's Greg in East Palo Alto. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Greg.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I've long thought that that the duration of patents and copyrights is too long, and again, this seems antiquated. I wonder if the duration of copyrights and patents is something that should be considered as far as a possible solution to this problem.
Good question.
Right. Well, this has been an issue I've been involved with literally for 10 years now. A decade ago, Congress passed the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, extending the term of existing copyrights by 20 years. This meant that the copyright term for human beings was life of the author plus 70. For a corporation, it was 95 years. Now, that compares with the framers' copyright term of 14 years, which, if the author was alive at the end of that 14 years, could be renewed to 28. So we've radically increased the term. And why have we done it? Because every single time a copyright's about to expire, at least over the last 40 years, the copyright owners have gone back to Congress and pleaded with them to extend the term of copyright. So 11 times in the last 40 years, Congress has extended the term of existing copyright. Now, we took this to the Supreme Court. We said, Supreme Court, the Constitution says Congress has the power to grant copyrights for a, quote, limited time. And we said, this is not a limited time. If at the end of the limit, you can extend it just because Congress wants to. And the Supreme Court said, I'm sorry, it's not our problem. You got to go to Congress.
Because
Congress.
Limit is not any particular limit, right?
I mean,
any time is a limit.
That's exactly right. So when I tell my 5-year-old he can take one cookie, and I turn around and he's taken four, and I say, what the heck? And he says, well, I took one cookie just four times.
Yeah, right.
He understands limit just the way Congress understands limit.
No, but is there any deep reason behind this? Or is it just the corporate interests got access to the Congress? I mean, is there any principle at work here at all?
No, there's no principle. This is just about people owning valuable monopolies, which are literally 2% of the work that is presumptively subject to copyright. 2% of this work has any continuing commercial value at all. They want to extend the term indiscriminately as long as they can, but lock up all sorts of culture, which we can't get access to because it's not commercially accessible because nobody can afford to clear the rights to be able to make it accessible.
Join this conversation, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or as always, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And we've got Charlie in El Sobrante on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Charlie.
Hey,
what's your comment
you.
Or question?
I got two quick questions. One, I'm curious what the Supreme Court, what their analysis was when they ruled in favor of the ban versus Roy Orbison. And my other question, I agree with your guest that plagiarists should be, you know, executed, but Doris Kearns Goodwin, you know, wrote all those presidential biographies, whatever. She was found to be a plagiarist, and she's still on TV giving her expert opinions about stuff. Okay, I'll take my answer off the air. Bye-bye.
Well, I don't know the particulars of the charge that you've made, so I don't want to comment on that. You know, what typically happens, especially with a lot of scholars, is when they're doing lots of note-making, they might make a mistake in exactly what they attribute as a note or not. But I don't know the particulars. I don't want to say anything.
But do you know about the Supreme Court case?
Yeah, I know about that very well. So what the court said was because Two Live Crew had so substantially transformed Ray Orbison's song, it was a fair use. And so they were free to do that and free to do it without the original artist's permission. And I think that's exactly the right instinct. Now, the problem is that same idea has not yet been articulated as clearly in the context of the current generation's form of artistic transformation, which is remix like Girl Talk engages in.
Right. I want to understand this. So if it's so transformed that it's what? I mean, what is the measure of transformation? If it's so transformed that it, say, doesn't compete with the original in any way or something, I mean, what's the measure of how transformed something has to be in order to become fair use?
The problem is there's no clear line. And what that typically means is often the right to, of fair use is the right to hire a lawyer, which for many artists is not much of a right at all. But the basic intuition is if what you're doing is building on and transforming a work in a way which is creating something different, you know, not like taking a novel and translating it or taking a novel and turning it into a movie. That's one kind of transformation, which is very much within the scope of the copyright owner's rights. But if you're taking a photograph and you're inspired to make a poster on the basis of the photograph, that's a different kind of transformation that the law has traditionally looked at and said ought to be free from the control of the original copyright
owner. Isn't there a controversy about that? Let me remind our listeners that this is Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the copyright wars with my guest, Larry Lessig. We'd love to have you join this conversation. 415-841-4134. Or, as always, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Now, I want to understand fair use and all that, and because let me look at, there's a controversy going on. I don't know remember the
details.
Let
me read your
it.
Mind. Shepard Fairey is in a lawsuit with the AP.
Right, exactly.
Because Shepard Fairey used as a reference photograph, a photograph by AP, to make his famous Hope posters.
And AP's upset, and the freelancer who took the photograph.
Well, the freelancer was working for AP, so AP owns the copyright. And AP's upset because Shepard Fairey didn't license the photograph that he used as a reference when he was making his poster.
Right, so help me think through this in a reasonable way. But what are the issues involved? What's the upside? What's the downside?
Well, I think you got to think about it very practically, right? So the question is, every time an artist uses a reference photograph in the context of producing a painting or a photograph, do we want a world where the artist has to have his lawyers call the lawyers for the other person who took the photograph? Because when AP was taking that photograph and using it the way they were using it, they never had in their head the idea, oh, wow, there might be a poster maker out there who we're going to be able to make money from, and that's why we're out there taking pictures in this way.
Well, wait a minute, though, but what's the big deal if suppose the guy had asked permission from AP?
Yeah,
probably they would have said okay. They might have charged him a fee or something. I don't know.
The fee's not the problem. They would not have said okay.
If you
would have called AP and said, I'm making a poster for Barack Obama's campaign. Can I have permission to include the AP photograph in it? What would AP have said? I'm sorry. We've got to be neutral in political campaigns, right? There's 1,000 reasons they're going to say no or want to control. Imagine they said, I want to see the poster. I want to make sure that I'm happy with the poster.
Wait a minute. Okay, so suppose that AP has some interest in this and they want to maintain their neutrality and they don't want their intellectual property utilized for purposes that they don't endorse. Is there something wrong with them being wanting? That's like, I don't want you to trespass on my house in order to blah, blah, blah. I mean, is there something wrong with them wanting to guard their own interests?
Well, but when somebody saw the Shepherd Fairey poster, nobody thought AP. Nobody had any association with AP at all because it was Barack Obama's picture in the... It was Barack Obama that the poster was about.
Wait a minute. So I'm not getting what you say. So should it now be in the public domain? Because in fair use, don't you have to... I mean, is it like something that should have been in the public domain or something that has to be cited and attributed? And if cited and attributed, then AP says, wait a minute, I don't want this attribution to me because I don't want to be associated, right? I mean, what's...
Well, I think that if somebody had taken the AP photograph and included in a book of photographs around the presidential campaign, they certainly would have needed the permission of AP to do that. But if what they do is they build on the photograph to make something like this poster, then even if they have to give attribution, which I think is totally the decent thing to do, to give attribution, people should understand that just because I'm attributing to somebody doesn't mean they're endorsing it, right? So they shouldn't have the right to stop it, and they don't have any obligation of endorsement if, in fact, I use it to build upon their work.
Right. See, this is like the quotation in scholarly. I often cite somebody to refute them,
yes.
Right? And they're not going to say, you can't cite me in the course of your refuting me because I don't want to be refuted. That would be an odd thing to do.
When I listen to these IP extremists talk about the control they want, I'm tempted because I would love the same control in the context of my own type of creativity. I read people who use my work in ways that's outrageous, and I would love to be able to say to them, I'm sorry, I'm going to go sue you because you've used my work in ways that I don't endorse.
So we've got a caller, a person who goes by Time Bender. He's an online visual remixer. I guess he doesn't want to give us his real name. Who wants to comment on this topic? Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Time Bender.
Thank you.
What's your comment or question?
Well, I wonder if Lawrence Lustig has talked about this at all. This photographer who took the shot of Obama, he said that was one of a few hundred he'd done that day, and maybe a few thousand in a year. He doesn't remember it right away. Well, because of the poster, the photograph is famous. He can make all kinds of money from it. Why is he suing him? Or why is the other guy even worried about a court case with him? It seems like the work that I'm doing, I'm pulling from a stream of millions of photographs, a few dozen. Those few dozen are seen by thousands of people who wouldn't have seen them otherwise. It seems like the person should be happy that we're using their stuff, yeah?
Right. The person would be happy, except then the lawyer comes into the room and says, I can make you even more happy because now I can sue and I can get you a chunk of the money that otherwise you wouldn't get.
That's an old idea. The lawyers are old. The people online like finding, they're like Easter eggs in a video game. It's like, oh, I know the artist who made this. Watch this. And you see the links happen from your work to the original work without saying who did it. It's a smaller world than we think, you know? This is kind of like a reforming network that's happening in real time. I put up 36 images out of a pool of 4,000 that I chose from. And then I see people emailing each other saying, this is from over here. You see?
Yeah.
It seems like a new way that's not being seen.
Time Bender, thanks for the call. I love your passion. I love, because it shows that there is passion behind this. This isn't just some kids trying to get away with crime. These are people actually trying to create and make new forms. And the law, I guess, is getting in the way of that.
Absolutely right. And you're right, Time Bender, that in fact, that turns out to be much more valuable for particular photographers. And that's one of the reasons why I think the law should look at it and say it's just fair use, meaning we don't have to bring the lawyers in, use it in a way that transforms it, and then you don't have to get permission in front.
Right. But don't usurp it. I mean, so
absolutely,
you're asking
right.
for the Time Bender to use some kind of judgment, right?
Exactly right.
Right. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the copyright wars with Larry Lessig, author of Remix, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy. George Harrison, who lost a famous copyright lawsuit when he unintentionally plagiarized another song. In these digital days, it's routine for musicians to have their music sampled and used in other songs. Some like that, some not so much. Part of the so-called copyright wars. And that's our subject today on Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything except your intelligence. John Perry is away. I'm Ken Taylor. My guest is Larry Lessig, author of Remix, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy. Okay, Larry, so you, Larry Lessig, you're king of the world, or at least the United States. Your word is law. briefly, how do you rewrite the copyright law?
Well, number one, I take amateur remix and I exempt it from copyright. It's not a fair use. It's just not regulated by copyright law. It should be totally free. Number two, face the fact that this war against peer-to-peer piracy has failed. I don't support people violating other people's copyrights, but we in the United States have got to learn to accept the idea of failed wars and stop suing kids and start suing for peace. So I would say the end to that war, legalize that activity, raise money to compensate artists for the harm that they suffer. Number three, make copyright more efficient as a system of regulation so that we exactly know who owns what. Right now, we have no clue about 90% of work that's more than 20 years old, who even is the owner of that. So we can't digitize it like Brewster Kahle in the Internet Archive is doing and make it accessible freely because we can't even find the person to ask permission of. Those are three changes that would have a radical change in the way copyright law
functions.
Okay,
join this conversation. The number is 415-841-4134. You just heard how Larry Lessig would change the law if he were king of the world. Now imagine that you are king or queen of the world. How would you change the way we handle intellectual property? Would you stick to the old system, or would you rewrite the law so that it serves radically different interests in radically new ways? 415-841-4134, and Eugene in Palo Alto's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Eugene.
Yes, I'm fully accepting of the notion that we've lost the old war, and I agree with his contention that we shouldn't, as a content creator, I don't like the idea of being punished because I create content that people believe should be for free. But it seems like browser companies know who is downloading my CD. Are we anywhere close to having some sort of system where, you know, with the connivance of browser companies, that we figure out how to charge people for stealing my music?
Well, if we build a system that tries to block people from accessing your music unless they've paid for it, I don't think we're any closer to making that system work than we were 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we launched the war against illegal file sharing on the assumption we could build that technology. We haven't been able to build it. But a different way of making sure you get paid is something we're very close to. So instead of trying to block people from getting access to your music,
right,
let's take samples the way they figure out who's watching what on television, right? After we figure out who's sampling, with that sample, who's downloading what's most popular, then let's compensate artists on the basis of the most popular work that's being illegally accessed, or at least accessed outside of the ordinary channels. So, and that way you would be making sure people got access without making sure that kids were criminals.
Thanks so much for the call, Eugene. But let me think about this a little bit. So I will pay a lot more for certain people than I will for other people. You know, there's this supply and demand thing. How would a system like this, you know, recognize the supply demand function, you know, that some people's work is more valuable? People are willing to pay more.
Well, notice there's a weird supply-demand function here, because if you're talking about digital goods, we can give you an infinite supply, right? But still, right, some people are willing to pay more just because they like it better, right? So this is not going to work in the traditional scarcity economics model. But what I'm saying is, given we failed to stop people from peer-to-peer file sharing, let's stop waging a war on that, turning our kids into criminals and getting no money to artists. Let's instead adopt a system where artists would get money, kids would not be criminals, and we could move on beyond this problem into facing more interesting problems.
We've got a good email from Karen in San Francisco. She says, an artist or inventor works in a way that is part of the interconnected web of ideas. For many years, inventors and artists have learned by copying the work of the masters. See European painting and Japanese art. The idea of pure originality and independence in the progress of human ideas is artificial. It is a misuse of creativity to prop up capitalism as opposed to the society treasuring and supporting culture. Instead of copyrights, I support the Japanese idea of artists as national treasures. Keep up the good work, she also says. What do you think about Karen's email?
I say listen to what Karen said. That was very well put.
I think it was very well put too, but there is this, I think there's something deep here. There's the cult of genius, the cult of the creator. And that's a kind of romantic 19th right. century notion. And I think that has something to do with this, right? Because you think of at the root of this is the individual creator who creates by the product of his own mind,
right,
and we want to foster and protect that.
Right. There's a confusion. Two separate ideas are not separated, right? So one idea is whether somebody is creative, and the other idea is whether they're creating on whole cloth, right? They're starting with a blank slate. Those aren't connected, right? So when you watch Girl Talk, Greg Gillis, who's this one-man Girl Talk, remix music to produce the extraordinary stuff that he's producing, every single sound he's remixing is sound that other people have created. But nobody could look at that and not think this is enormously creative. Yeah. Or my favorite example right now, if you go to YouTube, if you go to a site called Through, thru-you.com, one of the two, you'll see this guy who has gone through YouTube and taken slices of YouTube recordings where people were recording jazz and resynchronized it together to produce this extraordinarily beautiful remix, jazz remix, just from sampling things that other people have put out there. Now, you can't look at what he's done and think this is not enormously creative, artistic work.
Right, right, right. But one also does want to measure the value added of the individual creator and somehow compensate and encourage the adding value to other people's products.
Of course you do. But the point is, I don't think the law should be making that measure. It shouldn't be lawyers or judges deciding what is art and what isn't. It should be the culture that rewards people by saying that's fantastic or that's
crap. I agree with you. Ron in Palo Alto's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ron.
Yeah, I wanted to ask what your thoughts are on the enforceability of what really amounts to a private copyright act or a copyright contract that's imposed on works in the public domain by universities and museums. As if the University of California has a copy of the Mona Lisa and says, if you walk into my building, you have an implied agreement that any reproduction you make of this Mona Lisa, you have to pay us a royalty, and that royalty attaches to all reproductions and applies to anybody that receives one of those reproductions.
Yeah. I think it's outrageous. Jimmy Wales, who was the founder of Wikipedia, once shared with me an exchange he had with a museum where a 400-year-old painting was in Wikipedia. A person had taken a photograph, and the museum had sent basically this agreement saying there's no way this photograph was taken without somebody complying with this agreement, therefore you owe us royalties. And Jimmy Wales responded with a single line response, "Have you no shame?" And then signed Jimmy Wales Wikipedia, which is exactly the point. It's outrageous how much control museums try to exercise over these images. And you have these art historians who want to publish a book, their dissertation. Maybe 500 people will buy this book, but they pay $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 to clear the rights to works that are hundreds of years old in order to include them in that book.
Well, that's pretty amazing. I suppose they think the graduate students or the writers aren't really paying that. Some government granting agency is, or some university office, and it's a way of supporting the arts. I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, if the government's paying for it, then I think it ought to be free to the public. This is a big battle that's happening with John Conyers right now in Another Life I've Got, which is a Change Congress organization. John Conyers wants a bill that says basically when the NIH, the National Institute of Health, funds research, that research has to be published by a proprietary publisher. It cannot be a rule that it has to be published in a way people can freely access it. Now, that does no good to the public. It just benefits a bunch of foreign publishers. But it's an example of this confusion about how important it is to support this proprietary system for all forms of creativity.
I understand. You know, I ask you this question off mic, and I want to ask it just to give you, I know what your thought is. I keep struggling. You know, I'm a philosopher. I try to find the balance of reasons on both sides. I keep struggling to find what's on the side of the old-fashioned copyright regime. Is it really just big corporate interest, or is there any principle on that side? Is there anything to be said on a principled basis on its behalf?
You know, giving it as much charity as possible. You have a bunch of people who were very successful in a way of business that was built on top of a technology that's now 40 years old. And they're just trying to protect it, preserve it. I understand that. But I don't have any patience for legislators and regulators who get in bed with those people and start crafting laws that are stopping a new generation of creators and a new generation of businesses that could actually drive enormous economic wealth, especially here in the Valley.
On that note of passionate indignation, I think I'd call it, I want to thank you for joining us. This has been a really wonderful conversation. Too brief, but a really wonderful conversation.
I appreciate you having me back. Thank you.
Our guest has been Larry Lessig, professor of law at Stanford University, author of Remix, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy. And this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, the blog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And also, you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2009.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Cole Leahy. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merrill Kessler, Corey Goldman, Jennifer Jensen, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation. Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.